Was there an Adam? Was there an Eve? Or did we evolve from what we conceived? Either way, we got what we needed when the sun shone down on the Garden of Eden.
Don't you know we're gonna have a Solotopia, Solotopia, Solotopia. Don't you know we're gonna have a Solotopia all over God's green world?
Well, we bit the apple and the garden was lost, so we had to work pay the cost. And so we went digging into the ground and started to burn many things we found. But
don't you know we're gonna have a Solotopia, Solotopia, Solotopia.
Got rich, the poor got so. The fuel ran scarce, the price jumped high, and so they gave nuclear power a try. But
don't you know we're gonna have a Solotopia, Solotopia, Solotopia.
Yes, indeed, we're gonna have a Solotopia all over the God's green world. This is Harvey Wasserman back with another Solotopia Green Power and Wellness Show. We hope everything's good with you. We got a great show for you today. We got David Hughes and Ken Watzberger. David Hughes is a great activist and award-winning activist from Pennsylvania on energy and utility issues. And Ken Watzberger is publisher of Voices from the Underground, a great anthology of wonderful articles from the Underground Press. Are you guys with me today?
We are here.
All right, David, let's start with you. You just won an award. We had you on briefly last week, and I wanted to give you more time to fill in on all the great stuff you've been doing. So tell us what's going on in Pennsylvania, and you are semi-retired, I suppose. You started a group, or were part of a group called Citizens Power for many, many decades. Tell us what's happening with energy in Pennsylvania in terms of nuclear power and stopping it and then converting to green power.
Well, let me first mention that it is citizen power, singular. The idea is to empower the individual citizen to take action.
Okay, we like that.
I am the president of the board now. I've been bumped up from executive director, so I'm not...
Kicked upstairs.
Yeah, I'm not doing the daily operational stuff, but I'm still involved. And also, citizen power actually works in both Ohio and Pennsylvania. We work in the former ECAR region, so we cross the state boundaries the same as the utilities do. And we do a lot of stuff with First Energy in Ohio. So your question was kind of broad. I would say the two major issues that we're focusing on our electricity deregulation still since the late 1990s and its impact on nuclear power usage.
Uh-huh.
Specifically in terms of the nuclear power, the story, as you well know better than anybody in the country probably, nothing much has changed in the sense that these nuke plants are running and having problems all the time, including still Limerick and still Susquehanna in Pennsylvania, still Perry Nuclear Plant in northeastern Ohio, still Davis-Bessey out in Port Clinton. It's incredible, and it's connected to deregulation because these companies don't get reimbursed now for this generation like they used to under the guaranteed rate of return plan. So they've got to run these plants all the time, and that's why you had the near meltdown at Davis-Bessey.
One of many, no doubt.
Yes.
Let's talk about Davis-Bessey for a minute. Davis-Bessey is a nuclear reactor a little bit east of Toledo on Lake Erie. It is a well, why don't you tell the story, David? You can tell better than me. Tell us about what happened with the hole in the head.
The hole in the head was in the top management. They had serious holes in their heads because what they did is covered up a potential incredibly major disaster. They put a a new cap on that reactor vessel because of that, and it costs hundreds of millions of dollars. And, but what happened was, you know, through the cap, there are these nozzles that release pressure. They're like hose nozzles, you could say. And they're only turned on when necessary, almost never. But one of them was leaking for years, and in that water was boric acid. And it ate through the cap. It ate a hole the size of a football all the way through the 8-inch thick concrete. And the only thing that was preventing a major meltdown was a 1/8 inch piece of stainless steel liner that lines the inside of the pressure vessel. So that liner was bubbling up. It's 1/4 inch thick, but it was bubbling up into that hole from the pressure, and it was only then 1/8 inch thick, and it would have been only a matter of time had that burst, and then that would have been an uncontrollable situation. FirstEnergy covered that up.
Uncontrollable situation. Tell us what could have happened.
I'm not a nuclear engineer. Arnie Gunderson is the guy to talk to about that. But at the time, I was told by various experts, including folks at Union of Concerned Scientists, that anytime you even have a small hole, like they had at the Beaver Valley nuclear plant a couple years ago, the pressure is so huge that radioactive gases will escape out of there, and they can't stop it.
So we could have had a Fukushima on Lake Erie, basically.
I think so. I mean, you would have had a major breach of containment, and nobody knows how to, you know, correct that once it goes. You know, I mean, nobody.
Okay, we're talking with David Hughes of Citizen Power from Pittsburgh. Ken Wachsberger, you're there? Ken Wachsberger? I guess he's going to hang on the line. Okay, David, you're still with us.
Oh, yeah. I'm here. I'm on hold.
Okay, Ken Wachsberger is going to talk to us in the second half hour about the Underground Press, Voices from the Underground, fabulous four-volume anthology that he's put out. And but, Ken, if you'll stick with us, we appreciate it. David Hughes is telling us about how you almost got killed. Ken Wachsberger is in Ann Arbor, Michigan, and a blowout at the Davis-Besse nuclear reactor near Toledo. Certainly the radioactivity would have blown back at some point towards Ann Arbor and taken your life at very least, not to mention your home and your family. So, David, continue with us. Tell us that the Davis-Besse was 1/8 inch from destroying all of northern Ohio, Lake Erie, and what prevented it finally from happening?
Well, what happened was there was a bunch of ice and snow, ice on top of the reactor, and as my memory tells me, the NRC inspector had them remove that ice, and then they were able to see the hole.
Wow.
And to go to the very end of this, the NRC did, of course, a major investigation. And in that investigation, FirstEnergy admitted that they put operational, you know, profits, et cetera, production, they said, before safety. And this is because of deregulation, because they've got to run these plants all the time. You know, before, they got paid whether they ran the plant or not. Once it was put in the rate base, we had to pay for it. Now, under the deregulation scheme, it was like the only good thing that was supposedly came out of it. They have to pay for that, and they have to sell that power to make their money. So they're running these plants and their coal plants all the time, you know. And they're running these plants, these nuclear plants, when they often have problems that would normally cause a shutdown.
Wow. So the Davis-Besse nuclear plant has become infamous the world over. It's known as the hole-in-the-head reactor.
Right.
It's owned by FirstEnergy, which also now has the Shippingport reactor near Pittsburgh. Is that correct?
Right. In Shippingport, you have two units there. They are Beaver Valley 1 and 2. And FirstEnergy bought those when they made a deal with Duquesne Light.
Right. And Shippingport, which was the first commercial atomic reactor to open in the United States, has been decommissioned and it was sent through, well, actually the reactor pressure vessel went around
right.
the tip of South America
right.
and then back up to the Columbia River and up into Hanford.
Right.
So how are we doing in Pennsylvania transitioning from nuclear power to renewables?
Well, there has been, in the last 10, 12 years, an effort to get some wind online in Pennsylvania and Ohio. Part of the deregulation process, it didn't have to happen under deregulation, but part of the deregulation process, the environmental groups in both states pushed for an increased use of renewable energy technologies. And in both states now, we have some requirements for utilities to use a certain percentage of renewables. So it's certainly better than it was 12 years ago, but it's right now it's kind of leveling off, and it's in jeopardy, I think, of continuing to grow. We have to always monitor this because there are always forces attempting to stop this development. I mean, this development of renewables and, more importantly, energy efficiency technologies is a major threat to the mature technologies. And to
so
those.
this is a critical question for everybody nationwide, and nobody really has been dealing with it more closely than you on a state level. What is the, what I call King Kong in my book, Solartopia, coal, oil, nukes, and gas? What is King Kong doing here to slow the spread of Solartopia?
Well, one of the things they do is, for example, just recently in Ohio, you know, the Governor Kasich, when he came in, took a whole new look at the deregulation law and the various laws dealing with renewable portfolios. And there was pressure coming from the mature industries to get rid of a lot of the requirements. And you know, Kasich initially said that he was going to possibly soften a lot of the requirements, possibly even undo the renewable portfolio standard law. But a lot of heat was put on them from the environmental community because there's a lot of jobs being created, not to mention the environmental and health improvements.
Jobs being created in the renewable energy industry?
Yeah, sure. I mean, all the studies show that you create significantly more jobs through renewables and energy efficiency than you do through what you call King Kong. It's just clear. And it's just crazy that an energy source that would be clean and safe and, you know, has no, it's infinite, would be resisted by anybody. But when you're making all your money from coal and oil and nuclear power, you know, you try to do that. But they haven't been able to stop the growth of these new technologies, but they certainly do put the heat on them. Where they do it is in these state legislatures.
Well, how do they do that? How is King Kong fighting the Solartopia, the renewable energy industry in Pennsylvania?
Well,
specifically are they doing there to slow down?
Well, it's the same in Pennsylvania as it is in Ohio. I mean, coal is kind of king, and I'm not sure where it's the bigger king, if it's in Columbus or in Harrisburg. But one of the things that, here's an example. Citizen Power introduced the first renewable portfolio standards law in Pennsylvania back in 11 years ago. And it was a very beautifully written law. And by the time that law went through the whole process, they actually had changed it to the point where we could not support it.
Correct.
They actually put coal waste in the bill.
As being green energy?
Yes.
Wonderful.
Coal waste.
Yeah.
So this is how they work. They're very powerful. They pretty much own the legislatures. And it's a tough battle in most of these coal states. So, you know, we have to keep on fighting, but we're making progress, but it's... you know, you always have to be vigilant.
That's quite amazing. We're talking with David Hughes of Citizen Power in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, talking about he's just won a major award talking about the transition on the state level from coal, oil, nukes, and gas, or King Kong, to solartopia and renewable technologies. Hanging on the line with us is Ken Wachsberger. He's going to be with us for the second hour from Ann Arbor, publisher of Voices from the Underground, a magnificent four-volume output on the Underground Press of the 1960s and 70s. This is the Solartopia Green Power Hour, and this is Harvey Wasserman. David, have you had any success in Pennsylvania curbing nuclear power? Have we shut any reactors? Are we making them safer? What's the situation with in Pennsylvania and Ohio?
Actually, it hasn't really changed at all. You still have the same nuclear plants operating by Exelon and by PPL in Pennsylvania and First Energy in Ohio. the problem is, as you well know, these plants, many of them were due to, their licenses were due to expire in the next few years, but they've all applied for a criminal extension of their licenses. And the NRC, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, which is another bought and sold government entity, is approving these licenses extensions. In fact, they have never turned one down, amazingly. And even after Fukushima, where people, pro-safety people were saying, wait, even one commissioner who resigned, were saying, don't approve any additional licenses extensions until you take a look at the repercussions of Fukushima. But the NRC just goes ahead because it's a shill for the industry. So it's still a struggle. You know, even when you have a major accident like TMI or Chernobyl or Fukushima, it gives you an idea how powerful this industry is. And they have their supporters in the Congress, and they just keep going. And their supporters include Barack Obama, by the way.
Right.
His former chief of staff, Rahm Emanuel, who used to work for Exelon.
Well, now he's mayor of Chicago, so he's working for him again.
Yeah. So.
And, of course, Obama approved the $8.33 billion loan guarantee for the reactors at Volkel in Georgia, which we are fighting. And if you go to nukefree.org, nukefree.org, you will see a petition there under the Take Action section. We're asking people to sign that petition to stop these loan guarantees.
By the way, that plant, Vogtle in Georgia, about 12 years ago, 13 years ago, its spent fuel pool cracked and leaked 184,000 gallons of extremely high radioactive water into the water table around that plant.
Wow.
So. Stuff is going on like that all the time. I mean, if there's like 2,500 accidents a year in the U.S. at nuclear plants that range from minor to serious. The public doesn't know about it. That's why your show is so important.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that. We are trying to stop these loan guarantees. And, of course, at Vogtle, as I've reported at nukefree.org and elsewhere, the Vogtle reactor site, now they've already poured faulty concrete and are using substandard rebar steel. This is within the first year of construction. In a way, I mean, they're actually further behind now than they were when they started construction, because they have to do something about this substandard concrete, which is going into the foundations of the reactor, the two reactors there, and the rebar steel is either going to have to be pulled out, or what they'll usually do is they'll just rewrite the specifications to say it's okay, even though it isn't. We're talking with David Hughes from Citizen Power in Pittsburgh. David, how successful has the public opposition been in Pennsylvania and Ohio in altering the course of King Kong of coal, oil, nukes, and gas? What victories have you claimed over the past few years, and how'd you do it?
Well, I think, you know, if you measure it just on a flat basis, it doesn't look so successful. But if you measure it in terms of who has the power and who has all the money, I think we've been pretty successful in fighting these powerful interests. But, you know, the successes that we have had can be turned around by the coal and nuclear and oil industry if we just don't keep plugging away. I want to mention two points. One is the Beaver Valley plant, the Unit 2, which is the newer unit, I believe, yes, which went online in 79, which is owned by First Energy. We, Citizen Power, has been on top of monitoring that plant because they've found all kinds of cracks and holes in the containment, the concrete, which they believe were caused by poor construction originally. And this is a problem that connects to the fact that the NRC is extending the licenses of plants that are already getting old and giving them 20 and 40 year extensions when their concrete is breaking up, when their pressure vessels are getting embrittled. It's insane, really. And they're, you know,
do you think this disintegration of the concrete at the Pennsylvania reactors and at Volto in Georgia, is this a generic problem? Would you say, is it safe to say, David Hughes, based on your four centuries of activism, it's a likelihood that the concrete in all commercial reactors in the United States is disintegrating?
I can't say that, but I can say that there is a generic problem in certain types of reactors. We actually opened up a proceeding at the NRC regarding this. We had Arne Gunderson submit testimony on our behalf, and it appears that at least in maybe 28 reactors around the country, there seems to be appearing similar problems, and it has to do with the way the pressure is designed to be released in these reactors. I haven't read our report in like 4 or 5 years now, so I can't speak to it fluently at the moment. But I wouldn't say it applies to every reactor in the country, but certainly there's enough of them that have problems. And they keep showing up. The Volto, as you said, in Georgia, another one, Florida Power and Light Plant, I believe it was, Turkey Point.
Yes, Turkey Point.
And then Beaver Valley. So, I mean, there's several of them, you know.
Well, we should also point out, and David, you can tell me if I'm going over the top here, there appears to be a reverse learning curve with the nuclear power industry. For example, you know, Shippingport near you in Pennsylvania opened in 1957. And so you'd think that after 54 years, 55 years, this industry would have learned a few things. But let's take two examples. Crystal River in North Florida, they spent upwards of $1 billion to allegedly repair and upgrade this reactor, and they made it worse. In fact, they cracked the containment there as many as four times in the course of fixing the thing. I mean, it's like taking your car into the shop and they wreck your radiator or crack your block, basically. And then we have the two reactors at San Onofre in California between L.A. and San Diego. They spent about $100 million, as best we can tell, to upgrade the steam generators, which is essentially the cooling system.
Yeah.
And they botched the job so badly that they've had to shut these two reactors, and they may never reopen. This is technology that's been around a half a century.
Well, you know what, Harvey? Last week, I'm sitting right now 4 miles east of the Perry plant. And last week...
this is in Ohio.
Yes, on Tuesday afternoon... the emergency sirens went off.
Well, that's exciting.
At 5:20 p.m.
Uh-huh.
With no announcement. It wasn't the normal time for testing. Everybody flipped out, and everybody started calling radio stations, calling the plant, listening to the radio. We couldn't find anything out. And finally, it got on the news that night that it was an accident.
It was an accident?
Yeah, and the Emergency Management Agency of Lake County is investigating it now.
Well, wait, you mean it was an accident with the
No, the sirens, accident with the sirens going off.
Oh, my God.
And I said to a reporter, if they can't run those damn sirens, how can they run that plant?
Well, the answer is they can't. The Perry nuclear reactor is the only one in the United States damaged by an actual earthquake. I mean, how do they manage an earthquake? Well, in Ohio, it would be on me, but they did it. Until the... the North Anna reactor got damaged by a recent earthquake. We've been talking with David Hughes about the trials and tribulations of nuclear power. He's a great Pittsburgh-based activist. David, we just got a couple more minutes with you. Anything you want to wrap up with?
Yes. I want to say something that I think gives you an idea of why I am optimistic and why possibly we can change things. Citizen Power certainly started as an anti-nuclear organization out of the fight against the Perry and Beaver Valley nuclear plants to be put in the rate base. It was a crime that they were put in the base because the capacity wasn't needed and they were $9 billion over cost. But the way we think you can get rid of nuclear and coal is to increase the use of renewable energy and energy efficiency technologies. And we have a very exciting new development at Citizen Power for your listeners in three territories in Pennsylvania, in Duquesne Light, in PPL, and in PICO in the Philadelphia area. You can go to citizenpower.com, and you can get your electricity from us. And it's 100% Pennsylvania wind power, and it is cheaper than any other source. It is cheaper than dirty coal. It is cheaper than unsafe nuclear. I mean, this is a win-win. This is a historic new development. Before, you couldn't get renewable energy cheaper. It was always at a premium, which is why many people who are not environmentalists would not buy it. Now, you know, you can get clean 100% Pennsylvania wind. You can save money. It's just amazing.
Well, that's fantastic. And we did reach a tipping point in the last year or so where renewable energy worldwide, globally, has become cheaper than nuclear, even if you read Bloomberg and Fortune, all the big financial journals, they all say the same thing. And so now you have won this victory in Pennsylvania, and we're going to exceed these victories all over. Thank you so much, David Hughes, for being with us. In the next half hour, we'll have Ken Wachsberger talking to us from Ann Arbor, Michigan, about the great anthology Voices from the Underground. And David, give us a website as you leave.
Lowcostwind.com.
Lowcostwind.com. David Hughes, thank you so much. Ken Wachsberger, we look forward to talking to you after this short break.
Home sweet home to me. Solar-topia. That's the future for me. Green-powered energy.
All right, we are back. This is Harvey Wasserman at the Green Power and Wellness Show. Had a wonderful half hour to begin with David Hughes of Citizen Power in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, talking about the demise of the nuclear power industry, which we hope occurs before it demises us. Now we're on for a great half hour with Ken Wachsberger, my old buddy from Ann Arbor, Michigan. Ken, you with us?
I'm still with you.
All right, brother. Okay, now you're on. You have a magnificent four-volume set of articles and essays and artwork from the wonderful underground press of the 1960s and 70s. By way of disclosure, you have an article in there of mine called The Joy of Liberation News Service, talking about the founding of LNS and our infiltration by the FBI, leading to J. Edgar Hoover becoming the godfather of the anti-nuclear movement. Ask me about that if you get the inclination. We're at 888-874-4888. 888-874-4888 if you're inclined to call in. Ken, you're in Ann Arbor. Tell us about this amazing four-volume set of Voices for the Underground, if you would.
Well, it began way back when, in 1987, give or take, when a publisher I was working with, he owned a serial journal. It was a journal that went out to serials librarians, and by definition, the underground press is a serial, publication that comes out on some periodical basis. He was interested in the history of underground paper, just so that young librarians would understand what it was all about. He wanted to know how it was financed and what kind of police harassment it faced and what the successes were and how they made decisions and, you know, what events they covered and so on. And he didn't realize that I had already written one. I had written a history of the Lansing area, Lansing, Michigan area, underground press for one of the papers I worked with back when.
What was the paper called back then?
The paper I worked with was called Joint Issue, a pun on the word joint, because it was actually two underground papers that were struggling both to survive in a small radical community, decided to merge their staffs and merge their resources and come out with an experimental joint issue. So that's where the name came from.
Of course, everybody on both papers was smoking joints, so that kind of...
We wouldn't do that. Of course, it was illegal.
Under there.
But anyhow, so I wrote a history of that, of the papers leading up to those and then the papers succeeding them, the whole history, in other words, up to that time. And he loved it, and he got excited and asked me to be the editor of a special issue. And so I started to reactivate my network, because I had worked on the papers back then, of course, and I found such an incredible interest among veterans of the underground press. This was already, we were getting into the Reagan years, so the country was swinging way to the right. And nobody was interested in the underground press. Nobody was talking about the Vietnam War either. This was the catastrophe that our country was trying to cover up and pretend never happened. And so here I am saying, tell me about your experiences during the war. And so I got an incredible response from people who were sitting on these incredible stories. And so I worked with all of them. We ended up getting such a great response that this special issue became a special double issue, became a special, we ran articles throughout the year and a half. It was a quarterly, so that meant six issues. But we ran two or three articles sometimes. It was such a great response. And some of the stories were actually longer than could even fit in the journal. So I realized early on that I had a book. And it was an incredible book. As you know, it came out in 1993.
This is the first volume of Voices from the Underground.
First volume. The first edition, actually. It was a two-volume set. The first edition. The first first volume was all of these stories. They filled 600-plus pages in an 8.5 by 11 two-column format. It was literally the equivalent of four books. I mean, literally, if the books had been laid out in, say, a 7 by 10 or a 6 by 9 format. And then volume two back then was a resource guide to the period, the most in-depth resource guide to the period that existed. And so these came out to great acclaim for those who covered it. There was still a lot of censorship in the air, so some media that should have covered it didn't. But those that did loved it. And unfortunately, the books went out of print very quickly, and we weren't able to get them back in. And it was a frustration for me because...
Tell us what the underground press really was. I mean, a lot of our listeners know, those of us on Social Security, but a lot of our listeners won't know about the underground press of the 1960s. So give us a description. What went on with these wild and crazy papers?
The underground press was the dissident press, the anti-war press, the countercultural press, the non-corporate press. These are all different ways of saying it. But basically, the corporate press was, parroting the government. Whatever the government said, that's what they were reporting as facts. And as we all know, the government was lying about what's happening in Vietnam. So it took independent reporting to get the truth out. And that's what the underground press was all about. What was remarkable about the underground press, and this is what I've tried to capture in the Voices from the Underground series, which now in the second edition is the four books that it should have been back then, plus a few more stories that weren't in the first time around. What I discovered in doing that was that although all the underground papers were united in their opposition to the war, each paper really wrote to a unique audience. You had papers representing the gay voice, the lesbian, the feminist, the black, the Native American, the Puerto Rican, the military underground press, the rank and file, the union workers, the prisoners' rights, the new age, the southern consciousness, a term that I never really thought about until the Great Speckled Bird came on board the collection from Atlanta. And so
Speckled Bird was one of the great underground papers. I remember that very well. They were in Atlanta.
Absolutely. Absolutely, and, one of the great papers.
Do you have any idea where that name came from, the Great Speckled Bird?
No, I don't. I think I did it one time.
The people who put it out were sitting around on acid one night and came out.
Probably, yeah.
Probably saw this great speckled bird.
I think at one time I
could
have given you the answer, but I can't remember that now. but so what I did was,
well, of course, if you did remember it, then you weren't really there. So
that's what they say, right?
You gave the only credible answer.
Oh, gosh, thank God. No, I didn't remember everything. I just wrote everything, and so I could look at my notes years later. But what I did through this underground, through this project, was found representatives of all of these different types of papers. And so through Voices from the Underground, you get this incredible mosaic of what the anti-war movement is was all about. You know, the right wing has tried to relegate the anti-war movement to, you know, the voice of a few crazies on the extreme left. But the reality is that it was the broadest, most diverse anti-war community in the history of our country. I mean, that's it. There's no exceptions to that. The broadest, most diverse anti-war community in our country.
And it was very successful.
And it was successful. And it could be again today.
Well, one of the most, shall we say, satisfying moments of my life was reading, dare I say, a Richard Nixon's autobiography, in which he angrily said that he wanted to use nuclear weapons in Vietnam, but he was afraid that the anti-war movement would tear the country apart. I mean, if you ever wanted confirmation of your years of activism, that was really it. Can you imagine if Nixon had used nuclear weapons in Vietnam? What an insanely crazy world that would have opened up.
Well, the government leaders always tried to pretend.
The publisher of the Voices from the Underground, four volumes set. Who's the publisher, Ken?
Actually, Michigan State University Press is the publisher. I was the editor of it. I conceptualized it. I pulled together all the stories, and I worked with all the writers to edit theirs and to help them to expand them. I would have loved to have published it myself, but four books was just more than I could handle financially. So I really appreciated MSU Press going for it. They did a real nice job of it.
And how do people get these volumes?
They could go to voicesfromtheunderground.com, www.voicesfromtheunderground.com. The first three books are available now. The fourth book will be out in August, but you can place an order with it.
Okay, great. Now, tell us, you mentioned a very intriguingly a military underground press. Tell us about the underground press and the military back in the 1960s.
I think that once the military started opposing the war, that ended it. I mean, there was no way we, meaning the government, were going to win the war, meaning whatever definition they wanted to use, once the military turned against it. There was a huge military underground press and a huge military anti-war movement. I didn't really become aware of it until the 70s, but it already had begun in the 60s. Well, in the Voices from the Underground series, there are two stories about the underground press. One was a paper in Volume 1 by Nancy Stroll, who with her husband spent time in Yokosuka, Japan, which was where the USS Midway docked when it wasn't carrying the planes out to sea to bomb North Vietnam. So she and her husband put out this paper called Freedom of the Press, and it was addressed to the GIs there. In Volume 3, the current volume, there's a story by Harry Haynes about a paper that he worked on in Fort Carson, Colorado, called Above Ground. And both wonderful stories, but with Harry's piece, when he submitted it back when, and, you know, for the first edition, he also included a list of underground papers from the military. Harry's dissertation.
Now these are papers that were published by people in the military opposing U.S. military policy?
These were papers either published by or directed to. In other words, the paper that Nancy and her husband did was directed to members of the military. The one that Harry worked on was actually published by. But it was all branches, the Marines, the Air Force. I mean, all the branches had military underground papers all over the world. And these were really underground. I mean, you know, when those of us in the States use the term underground press, we knew there were certain dangers and be involved with it. But for the most part, meaning not including the Black Panthers and people like that, for the most part, we weren't going to risk our lives doing it. But when you were in the military and you were opposing the war, you were going against history, and you faced a lot of blowback. I mean, harassment and jail time potentially, and dishonorable discharge and scorn among your neighbors at home, and even rejection by the already established veterans groups. They didn't support their own troops because the troops were opposing the war. So what Harry did when he did his dissertation, like I was saying, on the underground press, he came upon a lot of different names. And so when he submitted his article to me for the first edition, he sent me a list of 200 some underground papers that were directed to or published by members of the military. He said, would you like to publish this? And I was thrilled. Of course I would want to, because this really highlighted the range of anti-war opposition within the military.
Well, how effective do you think this opposition was coming from soldiers? We heard about during the war and after, of course, we heard about fragging, where GIs would kill their own officers, often by throwing grenades into their bunks, which I think is where the term fragging came from. I may be wrong. But how effective were these anti-war papers within the military?
What Howard Zinn said was that Vietnam produced opposition by soldiers and veterans on a scale and with a fervor never seen before. That was a quote from historian Howard Zinn. Every war has had its share of dissident GIs, but never like the Vietnam War. This is what he said. There was a study that was published during the war, actually, that it concluded that their, and this is a quote, their morale, discipline, and battle worthiness were lower than at any time possibly in the history of the United States. I mean, that's amazing. This is a study published during the war. It said, by every conceivable indicator, our army that now remains in Vietnam is in a state approaching collapse. And then they referred to individual units refusing combat, murdering their officers, said they were drug-ridden, they were near mutinous. These are all terms that came right out of the report. So, yeah, the troops were not supporting the war, and there was no way that we could win in any traditional sense of winning a war. But
wow.
By the way,
Ken Wachsberger, publisher, editor of Voices from the Underground, a massive four-volume collection of articles, essays, artwork from the underground, the legendary underground press of the 1960s and 70s. By way of disclosure, I was a co-founder of the Liberation News Service back in 1967 and 68. We were infiltrated by the FBI, which succeeded actually in breaking apart the news service, and thankfully for that, because some of us went up to a beautiful communal farm in Massachusetts and then, lo and behold, helped start the anti-nuclear movement. In fact, that's why J. Edgar Hoover is an honorary godfather of the No Nukes movement. Thank you, J. Edgar. I hope you are spinning in your grave in your evening gown. We are with Ken Wachsberger. Ken, tell us some more about the underground press. What made it so unique back in the 1960s? What was
Let me finish one thought, because you asked about the military underground press, and
yes, please.
I was talking about the list of 200 some names that Harry submitted for the first edition. Between the first edition and the second edition, I met James Lewis, who is without a doubt the world's expert on the military underground press, and he submitted an appendix to Harry's appendix that listed another some 300 underground papers that were not on Harry's list. So right there we had some 500 underground papers, and you know, James is still doing research, and so already that list is outdated. But in volume two, the second edition, in the new book, we have this list of some 500. So it's an incredible contribution, and the military did just an amazing job of opposing the war. I mean, they made the difference as far as I was concerned.
When you say the military, you mean the actual rank and file, the soldiers, the GIs.
Oh, yeah, oh, yeah.
These are the people, the military itself. There were a few generals, actually, who came out against the war, I have to say.
Yeah, after the war was over, and after they had retired and their pensions were safe.
Right.
I mean, during the war, there was not a lot of opposition on the part of people who really could have made a major difference on their own. But again, the masses came together with the military
right.
anti-war movement.
And there is no doubt that the degradation of the military itself or the opposition within the military, from the rank and file, from the GIs and the grunts, this did make a big difference in war policy.
Absolutely.
No doubt about that.
Absolutely.
Ken, the nature of the underground papers, how were they produced? Where did they come from? Who paid for them? What really went on with these papers?
Every paper had its own unique characteristics. Some of them were paid for through ad sales. Others were paid through drug sales. Some were sold through, on the streets to individuals. Every staff had its own way of doing it. The paper that I worked on, we actually were the first paper in the country that I'm aware of, the first underground paper, to support ourselves simply on ad sales.
And what paper was that?
It was Joint Issue.
The
one that I referred to earlier, yeah. Some papers didn't like it. They felt that selling ads was capitalistic. We weren't that purist with it. We wanted to get the word out about the war, and we knew that we were spending lots and lots of time standing on the street corners trying to hawk papers for a dime, for 15 cents, for 20, for 25. It kept going up and up to pay the bills. But once we came out free, we didn't have to do that anymore. We just sell a few ads in advance, and then we could spend all of our time researching and organizing. So it was great for us, but it didn't work for other people. If you had a good, friendly drug dealer in town, he would donate money. Rock concerts, the rock musicians were very supportive back then. Decisions were made in different ways. Some of them were the traditional hierarchy, where you had an editor on the top saying this is what goes. Others were much more egalitarian. There was a strong move in favor of egalitarianism. Originally the papers were fairly sexist, the men making the decisions, the women, getting the coffee and doing the typing and all that. But as the consciousness was raised, the feminist movement, the LGBT movement, as the changes sunk in, that began to change too. So there were, never perfect in that regard. Some papers ultimately fell apart because of sexism, but there was always that effort at least.
Now, are there any of these papers left? Are there any actual underground papers still publishing?
Believe it or not, in this new edition is a story about the Fifth Estate from Detroit.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, it's the longest-running underground paper. I mean, that's still in existence. It goes back to 1965, I believe, it was when the first paper came out, and it's still around. It's still amazingly around.
Well, 65, now, that predates the Columbus Free Press, the Columbus, Ohio Free Press.
Correct.
Started in 1970.
You worked on that
featured,
one.
On one of its early editions, featured a cartoon of John Mitchell, the Attorney General of the United States under Richard Nixon, smoking a joint. That was one of my favorites.
Sure.
But the Free Press, for which I write, now freepress.org, we are continuous since 1970.
Now, the Columbus Free Press is
most
still
of the papers died, and the underground papers died
right.
in the late 60s, early 70s.
Is
very
the Columbus
few
Free Press still
1980.
Free?
But a guy named Dwayne Yeager kept it up, the Columbus Free Press, alive through the 1980s, and then Bob Fitrakis came in and picked it up in, I think, 89. And then in 1994 or 5, he got the www.freepress.org website, and we continue to go. So it's thrilling for me to continue to be able to write for something that dates all the way straight back.
And there's a wonderful story about the Columbus Free Press in this new edition also, this new volume, by Steve Abbott. Really, really
tell
wonderful.
Tell us about what's the story?
Well, just the history of the Columbus Free Press.
Uh-huh. Good.
My question is, because I can't remember, is it still a free paper?
Yes, but we do it once a year. There's a digest once a year, but there's a heck of a lot of activity every day on the website, the Free Press.
Because the Free Press
we publish a lot of stuff.
Uh-huh.
And in fact, the Free Press, Columbus Free Press, Bob and I, Fitrakis and I, broke many of the major stories on the stolen election of 2004.
I remember that. Wonderful stories.
And it was so much fun to be able to do that with continuity back to the underground press in the 1960s.
Right.
We're getting near the end here. What do you want to summarize about the great days of the underground papers and what was accomplished by these scurrilous, radical, drug-induced, the rumor was if you smoked one of these things, you get high. So tell us what's the great legacy of the underground papers?
Well, I'll tell you, what's important is that we're, and this is pathetic, actually, but we're still fighting the Vietnam War. I mean, this is a war that just does not quit. Every election we've had, somehow Vietnam has entered into it. I mean, the last election, Obama was accused of palling around with terrorists because he had been at some events with Bill Ayers.
Right. But, Bill Ayers being a graduate of the University of Michigan, my class of the University of Michigan in 1967.
I didn't realize that, but I'm an Ann Arborite, so it's great to have all you guys as veterans here.
Yeah.
But really, though, our government is still on a mission to whitewash the horrors of the Vietnam War. If you remember, President Obama kicked off a 13-year celebration. This happening 13 years with a speech May 28th, which was Memorial Day, at the Vietnam Wall. And the purpose supposedly was to finally honor the U.S. troops who fought in Vietnam, which sounds like a noble cause, but it really isn't, because the real purpose is to glorify the Vietnam War as a noble event and to relegate the anti-war movement, like I mentioned earlier, to a footnote written by a small minority of crazies on the left. They're trying to make war a little more positive, you know, glorify the troops, make it more attractive for younger troops to go, and make it easier to invade sovereign countries like Iraq and Afghanistan and Iran, and what the hell, why not China while we're at it? So this is why it's real important to remember what happened in Vietnam, to apply the lessons to today, and to keep the independent press alive. I hope that young bloggers today, the activist progressive bloggers, learn, you know, read the books here and learn that their roots are with the underground press.
Very good, Ken Marksberger. And you know, if we had, if you had described the internet to us in 1968, when we were doing Liberation News Service and all these other papers, we just said, whoa, bring that on. And here we are doing a radio show on the internet, which, there were underground radio shows as well. Ken Wachsberger, editor of the Voices from the Underground, thank you so much for being with us. What's
Thanks
the website?
For having me, Harvey.
Look at Voices from the Underground, Ken Wachsberger, a fantastic four-volume set. We are near the end here. Thank you so much. Another Green Power and Wellness Show. Thank you, Matt and the crew of PRN. And we will see you next week with the Green Power and Wellness Show once again.
And so we went digging into the ground and started to burn many things we found, but
don't you know it?